Welcome to Porch Stories on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Sarah Hegland. Every month, we invite residents of Central Iowa for a potluck and neighborly conversational storytelling. As we sit around the table and tell each other stories of our lives, we pass around the recording microphone so we can share them with you on the radio. So sit back, enjoy something to drink, and imagine you have joined us. Listen to the laughter and the joy of conversational storytelling. We are your neighbors. Today we're featuring one storyteller, Ursula Rudenberg. Ursula is KHOI's manager and chair of the board. She has worked in community radio for 13 years. She's Pacifica Radio Network's affiliate coordinator and works with around 200 radio stations in North America and Europe. Ursula grew up in Ames, and this is her story.
For most of my life, I was a professional mural painter. And this is the story about how my mural painting career ended. And it was in New York City. It was the summer of 2000. I was hired to do a very large job in Harlem, painting the full side of a school building in Spanish Harlem. You know, this was a public school, and the principal didn't really take responsibility for my welfare or my needs as the person painting the mural on his building. So I ended up having to rely on the dynamics of a lot of low-income neighborhoods in New York, as in many places, the things are managed on the street by some sort of social order. And in a way, these low-income neighborhoods are like villages, where there is a structure on the street that is sometimes stronger than, you know, the bureaucratic structures that exist. And so I was basically forced to rely on the structure of the street to take care of my needs, because I wasn't getting help from the principal. So there was a community garden next to the playground, and so with a little building in it, and that's where I kept my paints, which is really a location that anybody could have stolen from. And, you know, the thing about these neighborhoods is that these cultures tend to respect artists a lot, and so the leadership of the neighborhood, of people on the street, basically looked out for me. So, but even though these are relatively stable and strong structures, still, you're relying on the street. And streets in Spanish Harlem in 2000 was a pretty dangerous place to be. So it was a little bit of it was a hugely vulnerable experience for me, and I was working very long hours. So anyway, as I was working on this painting, it was a very interesting project. It was culturally very rich, but I wasn't making a lot of money. I was working way more than I should have, and I was basically not getting the kind of support I needed. And so I had finished being a graduate student in painting, and I was really thinking about this as realistically as a career. And I came to the conclusion that after about 30 years, I was done with mural painting, that this was just too physically demanding and financially not a structure that I could sustain. And that I realized if I wanted to make money with this, I'd have to do it differently, and I didn't really want to do that. And so I realized while I was working on this mural that this was my last mural. And it was a good one, so I was happy with that. So that was kind of what I was thinking about as I was painting on this mural. Now, in this particular case, this mural was kind of unusual because I wasn't actually supposed to have children work with me, which I usually did. But I had a scaffold that I was on, and, you know, anybody who's worked with children knows that if you walk into a playground with a scaffold, you know, that's a jungle gym. And so it's very hard. And then on top of it, you've got paint on there, which is also another child magnet. And so it's almost impossible to keep kids off your scaffold because you're just like a magnet. And so this was a grade school. And so I was constantly having to, like, kick these kids off the scaffold. And the school had a first story that kind of was a standalone, and then beyond that, it went up higher. But it had, like, this one level sticking out that I was, the level I was, kind of the wall I was painting on was only one story high, and it kind of had a roof, you know, around. It was kind of like this weird balcony where there was one floor, and then the building continued up beyond that. And there was, like, a wall, a relatively high wall, maybe 5 feet or 4 feet, you know, guarding the edge of the roof. So President Clinton came to the school while I was painting. There was some sort of music award ceremony. The school had a notable music program. President Clinton loves music. And so he showed up with Billy Joel at some sort of assembly. So that could be a whole story unto itself, seeing what happens when the president shows up somewhere. It was really fascinating, the structures that are built, and it's really quite something. And I actually went and saw him, and that was also very fascinating. But that's also not what the story's about. Well, the important part of that is that there's obviously a huge media frenzy when the president shows up. And a TV station had been running a cord from their unit up this one floor that I was painting on and into a window somewhere. And when they left the cord on the roof. And it was some sort of electrical cord. Okay, so a few days later, I was painting, and this one kid was really persistent, and he climbed up the scaffold, and I just let him hang out there for a while, because kids really, really love to do that. And then he climbed up the scaffold and jumped onto the roof of the building, which also was not actually an unusual thing. I mean, kids went up there a lot. It was relatively guarded, so it wasn't really a dangerous place to be. So I didn't go through a lot of trouble to kick him off. So he was up there, and he found this cord. And he decided he was going to go bungee jumping. Oh. So he ties the cord around his waist, and he jumps head first off the roof of the building.
Head first.
Head first.
Oh, my gosh.
And in a way, it's kind of lucky that the cord was too long, because if it hadn't been, he probably would have choked himself on the cord. So what he did is he fell headfirst onto the concrete.
Oh.
And this was like the worst kind. You know, this was like the concrete with the rocks in it, you know, like, and knocks himself out cold. And so I had to call the police and the emergency room, and obviously, I was mortified. And one of the kind of weird moments was that the program that had hired me, that when the police showed up, they asked me who I was working for, and I had to tell the name of the people I worked for, and they're called the Injury Prevention Program. And the cops, they all burst out laughing when they heard that. Which didn't help, you know, at the time. Of course, I was scared to death. Mm-hmm. The child's mother showed up. He was had a single parent. And I went with her to the hospital, the Harlem Hospital. And the child stayed unconscious for, I think, about 8 hours.
Oh.
And so I stayed with her. She was actually very, very nice to me, considering. She was very kind to me. And she and I stayed in the hospital for the whole time. And, of course, you know, my life was flashing before me. I was thinking that, you know, I was going to be responsible for the death or the, you know, permanent mental illness of a child. And I was doing some heavy negotiating with God then, too. I mean, it probably was one of the worst moments of my life. But there was really nothing you could do except wait. And doctors really didn't know what to do either. There was really nothing they could do. So we all just waited and sat in this hospital for hours and hours. And after about 8 hours, the kid woke up and didn't seem to have any apparent effects from it, and was out in the playground the next day running around again.
Wow.
So that in itself is just kind of like a lesson in, you know, the resiliency of youth. But they really checked him out pretty carefully, and they really said there really, really no worse, no real consequences. there was a father involved who had abandoned the family. When he heard of this, he tried to come and sue me because he saw an opportunity. And that was the one time the school principal did something. He defended me. And so, you know, I've got to be grateful for that. Mm-hmm. So, okay, that's the first part of this story.
And all the streets of Rome are filled with rubble. Ancient footprints are everywhere. Well, you could almost think that you're seeing double. On a cold, dark night on the Spanish stair. Gotta hurry on back to my hotel room, where I got me a date with Botticelli's niece. She promised she'd be right there with me.
Welcome back to Porch Stories. Today we're listening to a story from Ursula Rudenberg, the manager of KHOI, about the end of her mural painting career. Let's listen to the second part of her story now.
About a week later, by this time it was August, it was very hot out, so I was working evenings, and I would work until about 1 o'clock in the morning, because everybody was on the playground at night anyway. The street lights were on, and it was just not possible to work during the day. So around midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning, I would walk up Lexington Avenue, take the train at 125th Street, which is the main street in Harlem, and go to Brooklyn, which was about an hour ride home. And as I was walking, I followed this one path that I would go up, and it would go through a street that was extremely run down. These days, probably it's luxury apartments. It was a lot of empty buildings and some very, very low-income buildings. And just like one of these streets that were kind of terrible. You know, the level of neglect and poverty is somehow has such a shabby look that there's something kind of frighteningly terrible about how it looks. And it was one of those streets. And I would walk up the street and I began to realize something really, really strange, which was that when I was a young child here in Ames, living in a beautiful, beautiful environment on Highland Avenue, I would have nightmares about the dark city. Mm-hmm. And I began to realize that the street that I was walking in Harlem was the street that I used to dream about when I was a child. It was the exact same street. And all of a sudden, I could no longer tell the difference between my internal world and the external world. They had become, somehow the barrier between them had disappeared. And I didn't know what to think. I couldn't tell what was me and what was out there. And so I didn't know what to do. And so finally I said to myself, well, the theory in dreams is that everything in a dream belongs to you. It's all you. So the only thing, the only wise course of action here is to assume that whatever this is, this street, is part of my dream, and so it's part of me, so I shouldn't be afraid. So I just won't be afraid of this. Because I was pretty scared by this. And plus I was upset about this child. And so I started to walk through the street at night very deliberately, because I knew that I was frightened because of this nightmare. I began to walk really deliberately and intentionally and say, just look at everything and don't be scared, just look at it. If this means something to you, this belongs to you. So after about two or three nights of this, I'm walking up this street, and there's a man in a wheelchair sitting in the middle of the street. Otherwise, the street's completely empty. And he's a little bit drunk. And he says to me, come over here. So my first instinct is like, this is a setup, you know. But then I said, no, I promised myself that I would not be afraid of anything. So I went over to him. And he said, I'm paraplegic, and my brother usually takes care of me, but he's not here tonight. And I need to get money out of the ATM machine. Will you help me? So I'm like, okay, I said I would do this. So I said, okay, I'll do this. So we go over to this ATM, to the bank, which is just, you know, like right down the street. And then he says, will you help me out of my wheelchair? Now this means he has to put his arms around my neck. Okay? And so I thought twice about it. Now, I have been the victim of many crimes, so I'm not in any way naive about the potential for violence or setups. But I said to myself, no, this is what I agreed to do. So I said, go ahead. So he put his hands around my neck, and, you know, and I kind of leaned over, and I stood up to lift him up. And somehow his grip, maybe he was afraid of, you know, choking me or whatever, his grip slipped, and he fell. And a paraplegic falls like a sack of potatoes. You know, there's nothing, they fall like a corpse. And so for the second time in about a week, I watched somebody fall head first onto the concrete in front of me. And I just became completely mortified and like, why are people falling head first on concrete around me? You know, what is this? And so anyway, I went through a lot of trouble to like get him back up on his feet. It was really hard. He was very heavy because he had no muscles to support himself. So finally, I get him up on his feet. And then he says, oh, my credit card broke when I fell. So I'm like, really, you know? So he said, can you try and make this work? So I'm like trying to make this work. And finally, I get it, the door to open. So I drag him into this ATM little place, and we're standing by the door where one of these tables are where you write your checks or whatever, and down at the other end of the room are the ATM machines. And when we get to this table, he kind of leans on the table, and then he turned around, and he looked me straight in the eye. He looked completely sober. In fact, he kind of looked like a boss. And his eyes became totally clear, and he said to me, you did very well tonight. And I said, what? You know, like, what's this guy going to say next, you know? And he said, and then he reached over, and he touched my arm. And he said, no, you did very well tonight. You can go now. And he said it like there was no arguing with him, like he was the boss now. And I said, how are you going to get to the ATM machine? How are you going to get to your wheelchair? How are you going to get anywhere? You can't walk. And he said, you can go now.
Oh my gosh.
And so, you know, when somebody tells you to leave, you leave, you know, especially in the ghetto. So I said, okay. And I turned around and I walked out. And I went home. And I just said to myself, wow. But you know what? I have had it with the old people. This is it. You know, yeah. This is it. You know, this is more than I can understand or want to understand. And so I the next day, I noticed that while this was all going on, that the custodian was cleaning the bank in the, you know, behind the glass. So the next day I went to the bank when I knew the custodian would be there, and I said to him, did you see the man that I was in there with last night? And he said, yeah, I saw that. So it happened. Mm-hmm. And so I said, so how did he leave? And he said, I have no idea.
Oh.
And that was the end of my mural painting career.
Wow. That's great. So there's a mystery to it?
Spellbound story.
I would say that if anybody would have story of when I saw an angel, this would probably be mine.
Right.
I have no explanation for who that man was.
Right.
But at the end of the day, he had total authority, not me.
Joining us around the table for Porch Stories, where we have just heard a story from your neighbor, Ursula Rudenberg. The music you heard today was Home Sweet Home by Bray Brothers, When I Paint My Masterpiece by The Grateful Dead, and Liama by Cirque du Soleil, which was from a Cirque du Soleil CD that Ursula was listening to at the time when this story took place. Porch Stories is a production of KHOI Radio and is broadcast Wednesday evenings at 9:30 p.m. These stories come from regular events held every month, and everyone is welcome to attend and share your stories. The next event will be held Friday, June 21st at KHOI Studio, the Pantorium in Ames, 410 Douglas Avenue. The potluck begins at 6:30 and storytelling at 7 p.m. We look forward to hearing your stories. Thanks to our production crew for this episode, Joe Myers-Walker, Rick Morrison, and me, Sarah Hegland. KHOI is building community through communication. If you'd like to tell a story, please email khoiradio@gmail.com or phone 515-292-2878. See you next week.